From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us in studio is Mary Chay. She is a D.C. council member, a Democrat, representing Ward 3. Councilmember Chay, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with David Anderson. He's a candidate in the Democratic primary for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. But first up, the proposed agreement, the merger agreement between Pepco and Exelon. Joining us for that conversation is Vincent Morris, Regional Communications Director for Pepco Holdings. Vince Morris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo, and I'll only be on the air for a minute because there's not much we can say at this point. We're still reading this this new ruling that we got from the Public Service Commission.
I'll decide how long you'll be on here, Vince. DC's Public Service Commission voted to send a revised merger agreement to Pepco and Exelon for consideration. The utilities have 14 days to accept or reject it. Vince, what's in that revised agreement?
Well, Kojo, Tom was there, as was Councilmember Che, so they can show you, and there's a copy online. There's new provisions, and honestly, the order that was released today has new provisions that we and all the other parties to the settlement have to review before we can say whether they're acceptable or
are
not.
Are you optimistic? Hey, Vince, Tom Sherwood, are you optimistic?
Hi, Tom. I'm an optimistic person, but I can't tell you at this point.
Was Pepco optimistic?
Pepco and Exelon and all the other settling parties, remember, there were many parties to this agreement. They all must review it and decide if the new provisions that were put out are acceptable. And once we've had a chance to study that and look at them, then we'll have more to say about what our next steps are.
The Public Service Commission gave you 14 days. The Exelon corporate executives had said they would want an answer by March the 4th, which is next Friday. Do you anticipate you'll meet either one of those 2 weeks, the first week or the 2 weeks?
We're looking at it right now, Tom. As soon as I get off the phone, I'm going to read it all over again.
So there's not really much else you can add to this conversation, is there, Vincent Morris?
I warned you, Kojo. I'd love to come on another time and talk about all the great things that Pepco is doing in this area. But right now, in terms of the order, we have to study what's new. And once we do, we'll have more to say about what it
means
and what our next steps are.
Well, as you pointed out, both Tom Sherwood and Mary Chay were there this morning. So keep listening. And if you hear them say anything to which you object very seriously, don't hesitate to call us back if that happens to be the case. Vince Morris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
That is the first time I've ever heard that invitation to anybody.
Yeah, because you two are going to say things. Tom Sherwood, I'd like to start with you. What is in that agreement that I asked Vince Morris about?
What did the Public Service Commission require?
Yes.
Well, you can disagree with me, you can call me up and tell me later. Here's the deal. This is a $6.8 billion merger. $6.8 billion merger. The conditions over which the public service decided this are just maybe less than $75 million in most cases, and whether or not this merged company would be required to build a solar facility down at Blue Plains near the water treatment facility. If I may say, someone who is connected, who wants this merger to go through and is involved and was involved in the negotiations, told me afterwards that these conditions are like scraping gum off the bottom of your shoe. They will not be hard. They won't be difficult. They won't take long. And this merger is going to go forward because the Public Service Commission said they will not vote again. If they agree to these conditions, they're going forward.
Before I go to Councilmember Shea, tell us a little bit about the procedure that took place this morning, because there were two votes and both of them ended up 2-1. People should know the commissioners are Commissioner Joanne Dottie Fort, Commissioner Willie Phillips, and the chairperson is Betty Ann Kane.
That's correct. Last fall, after I can't remember how long, the Public Service Commission rejected the merger. And Betty Ann Kane, the chairman, said in the statement that it was not in the public's interest of the citizens of the District of Columbia for Pepco, which is a pass-through power company, doesn't generate power, to join up with Exelon, which is a major company that creates power. And they rejected it. But Then the parties, Pepco and Exxon, appealed, and they went to Mayor Bowser, and they worked out a deal with about $75 million of enhancements for for ratepayers in the city, some more attention to the city, moving some offices here and some other things like that. And then they appealed, and that's what the commission voted on today. It voted again today and said it still wasn't good enough. It voted 2-1 to reject this merger, and people cheered in the who were there who didn't want it cheered in the room. But then Commissioner Fort, Joanne Dottie Fort, said, well, the second vote's going to be, if we make a few changes, I'd support it. And so she made these proposed changes, again, quite minor changes, and then they voted 2-1. Betty Ann Cain said this was an entanglement. As the chairman, she said, it's a terrible thing that we will come to regret this merger. But it's going to go forward as long as Pepco and Exxon do these little changes that the commission asked.
So can we assume that Commissioner, the chairperson, Betty Ann Cain, will continue to be opposed to it, and that the other two commissioners...
There will be no more votes.
There will be no more votes.
They voted today. The commission voted, said, you make these changes, these few changes.
What if they don't make the changes?
Well, then they won't go forward.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. You can send email to Kodjo at WAMU.org. What do you think about this merger? You can send us a tweet at Kodjo Show, or go to our website, kodjoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the conversation there and ask a question or comment. Our guest is Mary Che, D.C. Council Member. Council Member Che, you along with several council colleagues recently sent a letter to the Public Service Commission urging it to reject the terms of the settlement as it stands. You were there this morning. What do you feel about what happened today, and what are your concerns now?
Well, this was a great loss for the District of Columbia because, as Tom said, the conditions, the additional conditions that have been imposed are at the periphery. They're minor. The settling parties will immediately come and agree to them. I don't see any reason why they would not. And the commission, two members of the commission, said that, and if that's the case, then this is a done deal. So it's effectively a done deal. And it's a bad deal. And the chairman of the commission, I want to applaud her. She acted with courage and integrity to identify the real problem with this deal. It's not whether certain funds shall be allocated in this way or that. It's not whether Exelon had given itself the sole source for building certain solar panels at DC Water. None of that is the heart of it. The heart of it is we have a financially stable, well-run company that distributes electricity. We're joining up with this behemoth company distant in Chicago that is based on a business model that's a century old. And it's financially troubled, its stock has fallen, and what it wants to do is gobble up really good companies to balance its bad business. And now, they've made this marriage with us, which is hardly a marriage. I think if I were parents of this marriage, I would, quickly move for annulment. But it's very, very bad for the District of Columbia. This is a company that is not anything about what we're about. We're about saving electricity. We're about environmental progressivism. We're about renewables. They want to sell more electricity. They're in the business of generating. It's a complete conflict of interest, and the chairman herself said that.
The supporters of
if that doesn't warrant a call back from Vince Morris,
well,
I don't know what will.
I might preempt him by saying this. The supporters will say that the states of Maryland, New Jersey, and Delaware, and Virginia have all approved this merger, thinking it would be in the best interest of the ratepayers in those states. Why is it such a horrific deal for just little old District of Columbia?
Well, first except of all, that now we get to act like a state, so don't call us little old.
Well, first of all, it was very divisive in Maryland, to be sure. And many leaders there did oppose it. Their commission ultimately did, by a divided vote, approve it. But the one of the main points of difference is that we are not a generation business. We're a distribution business.
Basically a pass-through.
That's right.
You buy the energy and pass it through to customers.
Exactly right. And
you meaning Pepco.
And Pepco gets a rate of return, which is very robust, over 7%. It's a regulated industry. The one thing that was being said, well, we join up with Exelon and we'll have all these more resources. We'll have a more reliable company. The fact of the matter is the promises of reliability in this agreement, are ones that for the near term that PEPCO's already meeting. And the reason why PEPCO had reliability issues previously was not because they didn't have the ability to become more reliable. It's that the Public Service Commission wasn't putting down the hammer. When they finally did, they came up to par.
Well, what's in it for PEPCO? Is it were they?
Oh, they're going to make a bundle. Oh my goodness, the shareholders.
I've got a surprise for you. Guess who's on the line?
Vince Morris.
The shareholders. This is a big windfall for them.
I thought he was too busy to be on the line.
Vince, he should be reading.
Vince
Mr. Morris. Morris should be reading.
He's listening. Vince Morris, care to respond to anything you've just heard? Vince Morris, are you there?
I'm here, and I appreciate the opportunity. But at this point, until we've read the fine print, I can't give you anything else.
Did you call back, or are you just listening on the phone?
He was listening. He was listening on the phone. But while we have you on the line, Vince Morris, before you go on another issue, we're going to get back to the deal in a second. But we spotted a rash of posts on neighborhood listservs citing skyrocketing PEPCO bills in the past few months, despite little change in usage. Some attributed to the smart meters that they say are not so smart. Have you heard about this issue? Do you know what might be going on?
I'm surprised by that, Kojo, because for the most part, the smart meters that we've put in around the PEPCO system, the PEPCO area, have been, for the most part, allowed people to reduce their bill. The smart meters allow you to control your consumption of electricity, to use off-peak, to use the off-peak opportunity for your billing. And for the most part, we've heard nothing but praise from customers about that new technology. Well, and the other thing, Kojo, it does is it allows us to reduce outages. And I think you probably have seen the last couple of storms that have blown through here. Our customers have had minimal impact. We've had very few outages, and the few outages we've had were restored almost immediately.
Mary Chase says that's after the Public Service Commission put down the hammer. But Vincent Morris, we're not hearing you very well, and I know you have other business to attend to. So this time, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
Kojo. Sounds like he's in a fishbowl or something. Hey, well, this was a 270-page order, the thing that was voted on today. And, of course, PEPCO and Exxon do want to look at it. But there's no controversy. There's no complication that the lawyers in that room and the executives in that room could not see and do not see that these are very simple conditions upon which to make this merger go forward. But what happens next, Mary Che? I ask you at the commission floor there, what do the opponents do now? And you say basically there's really nothing they can do.
There really is nothing they can do. When an administrative body in a thorough way goes over the record and comes to a conclusion, you always have the option of taking something to court to say that it's arbitrary and capricious. But those are extraordinarily hard kinds of cases to win. So it'll be effectively over. I mean, anybody can file a suit about anything. But, I mean, if we're talking about a realistic opportunity to stop this, I don't think one currently exists.
Well, we should point out that you are, in fact, a lawyer and law professor.
Yes.
Well, is it Georgetown or George?
George Washington.
I can never get them.
She moves around.
No. Always George Washington over 30 years. Now, I want to say something about the conditions because they highlight what was wrong with this agreement from the beginning in terms of the settlement agreement. Among the things that the commission is requiring is that there are little pots of money that Exelon promised to give to the city for various things. But they're not directly related to ratepayers. They're not directly related to the grid. Instead, they were pots of money that essentially the executive branch, I don't know who negotiated this, would be able to use as if giving the mayor a candy store, and she could distribute the candy.
Sounds like walking around money.
Yes, walking around money. And so one of the conditions is, and this is not hard for Exelon to agree to, that money should not be devoted to those things. It should be devoted to things directly related to ratepayers.
And that the Public Service Commission would retain authority over how that money is spent,
right,
as opposed to just going to the mayor to hand out.
Right, so exactly. So it's not a big deal for Exelon. It's just a loss of, what do you call it, walk-around money?
Walk-around money. We call it in politics.
It's a bookkeeping matter.
It's a bookkeeping matter. And then, one of the other conditions is that PEPCO Exelon granted itself in the settlement agreement the option, whether it would or not, to be the party to have the five megawatts of solar and microgrids installed. We were going to do these things anyway, okay? But what the commission said, or the condition was, no, that actually undercuts competition. You're not giving us anything. You're saying that you're willing to do this, to be paid to do this. And so now you have to submit that to, you know, competition. You just don't get it automatically.
And DC Water will decide who builds that.
I mean, if you start thinking about it, these kinds of conditions, they're so easy to satisfy. It's hardly a nick in the deal as far as Exelon is concerned. And again, it does not go to the heart of the matter about why it's so bad for us to align ourselves with this company that has a completely opposite view of electricity and the environment.
At the risk of every listener turning his or her radio off, I want to ask, one of the conditions is that PEPCO and will have to change something to do with microgrids. Can you tell us as human beings what that means?
Well, you know, we have a great big grid, and
right.
electricity
we
flows.
We all understand the big grid.
Right, the big grid. But what this would do is, you know, in terms of particular operations like universities or other entities like that, you can create little microgrids. They can create their own power, which they can do sometimes with heat that's thrown off or other methodologies. For example, DC Water is producing methane into electricity by these digesters.
So that's a microgrid.
Right.
Is that good or bad?
No, these are all good things. Okay. And in fact, one of the reasons why they're good things is because it allows us to focus where we have energy saving and energy production opportunities. But also, here's the other thing. Somebody from the Board of Trade came in to argue for the Exelon merger, saying, well, you know what, we need, you know, a big company to protect us against, you know, cyber attacks and such. It actually works the opposite way. As you decentralize, the more protected you are against attacks on your system. And so that's what these things are.
On to the telephones. Here is Nick in Washington, D.C. Nick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo, Tom, Mary. Thanks for having me again. It's good to hear you guys together again. So my question is that, you know, it seems like a lot of the opposition here is motivated by ideological differences. And while I do sympathize and agree with that position, I wonder just, you know, in the sense of utilities and practical reality, you know, for those of us who can't afford to base our financial decisions on ideology, my question is this actually going to be affecting prices for those of us living in D.C., or is it just a matter of
And I suspect, Mary Che, that is what most listeners are concerned about. How will this affect my rates? How much will this cost me, or how much will this save me?
Okay, let me just say, this is not mere ideology or mere, you know, philosophical disagreement. There are real practical, concrete consequences. First of all, Exelon promises that it's going to not apply, or they're going to create a fund so that you don't have to pay any rate increases until 2019. And that seems like a boon, right?
Yes.
And once that's used up, and by the way, one of the other conditions is that non-residential ratepayers have to get the benefit of that too. So it's going to have to be split. But that does not mean, nor should it be seen as a protection against rate increases. The rates will increase. And then in 2019, the new rate that you pay will be cumulative of all the rate increases along the way.
Which would have to go through the Public Service Commission, however, right?
Right. But, I mean, they're entitled to a rate of return. And if, you know,
they just promised not at the start to not raise rates until 2019, which everyone should pay attention, is just 3 years away.
Right.
And then they can do whatever company thinks it's in its best interest.
Right. But when Exelon took over in Baltimore, they had a rate increase every year thereafter. Okay, a rate increase that was approved every year thereafter. That's number one. So it's not as if you're getting anything out of that. On top of that, we're committed to renewables and other environmentally progressive policies that reduce the use of energy, which naturally will reduce cost. In addition, we're interested in finding the best deal on the energy that's sold in the District of Columbia, because we're only a distribution, or as you say, pass-through company. So we don't care where we get the energy from per se. We want the best deal. Exelon is in the energy production business. They want us to use more energy so they can sell more energy. Now, there's something in this deal that's almost, proof positive that this is a conflict of interest. There are these provisions that they call ring fencing. And for a time, they will put a ring around PEPCO's operations here and I guess some of the other places where they've taken over and not let them get commingled with the financially troubled aspects of Exelon with its nuclear power deal. But that doesn't last forever, and commingling is a funny thing, you know, whether you're commingling or not commingling, and it's unclear, it's entirely unclear whether we will be insulated even from the beginning from the higher costs of Exelon.
The chairman of the Public Service Commission said that she was quite concerned about PEPCO being, quote, entangled, unquote, mm-hmm. with all of Exelon's other interests.
So it's very concrete. It's very specific. It's very practical. In the long term, we will be paying more and saving less.
Here is Cedric in Washington, D.C. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. Glad to join you. The question that I simply have is, if we've had two votes by the commission that said this deal is not in the public interest and it's not a good deal, and the changes that are suggested in no way alter that, how can we as citizens feel at all comfortable and confident in this deal? Nothing's changed to make it in our interest.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that's why, you know, it's very demoralizing to have witnessed what we witnessed this morning. Initially, they said it was an inherent conflict. We shouldn't join up with this company, given our different, ways of operating. And then today they said it was still an inherent conflict. But if you made these modest changes, which, again, don't go to the heart of the matter, now we'll approve it. But the caller's quite right. It's the bad part of this remains bad.
Well, let's see what Anya has to say in Washington, D.C. Anya identifies as being from the D.C. Solar United Neighborhoods. Anya, your turn.
Hi. My organization, D.C. Sun's, actually been an intervener in the case, and we've been involved from the very beginning. And I just have two core points to make. I just finished reading the proposed revised settlement from the PSC, and there's two things you guys need to understand. One, there was a $25 million residential rate credit that was going to be dedicated to prevent these rate increases till 2019. Now all bets are off. That money goes in escrow to the PSC, and the distribution of it gets decided in rate cases and could well mean that we're getting rate increases way before 2019. That guarantee is completely gone.
What's the second point?
I really don't think that the People's Council could now support this proposal because the thing
she
they
does.
Most wanted was that rate protection.
Okay, second
the
point.
Other thing is $29 million were taken away from the mayor and put under PSC control. And it was a real slap at the mayor about the way that they were really trying to fill their kitty with a bunch of pet projects.
That was the walking around money that Mary Chay referred to earlier.
Yes, well, I want to say her name correctly. Sandra
Madhavu Fry,
who is the People's Council. She is the person in office to represent the ratepayers before the utility, gas and PEPCO. I asked her after the vote, does she support it? And she said she did because, you know, when it was revived, when the mayor came out with her proposed $78, $75 million enhancements, she supported it then. And then the mayor reappointed her as People's Council. And she said, told me today, objecting to what Mary Chay has said, that these rate cuts, these $50 a month or whatever, it's important to people who are lower income and not for high income people. They may not care so much about
They're
it.
They're not rate cuts,
withholding rates.
What our caller seems to be suggesting is that in the proposals that are being sent on now to PEPCO and Exelon, that money is now being taken out of the mayor's hands and put in the hands of the Public Service Commission, and that on that basis, the People's Council might object to it.
No, the Public Service Commissioners want the money to be controlled. They want to be able to have a say if the money is not properly spent. If it just goes to the mayor, then they don't have a say. That's all it is. There's no criticism of the mayor. It's just simply they want to oversee the money.
Okay, here is Greg in Washington, D.C., and then we've got to move to another issue. Greg, your turn.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Look, I want to ask Councilmember Che how she can be a fully tenured professor at law at George Washington University, drawing a salary of $200,000. And GW has 50% of their holdings in real estate in Washington, D.C. The average for other universities is 7%. Yet she talks about conflict of interest. Clearly, you cannot be a professor for a university that operates more like a REIT
Or like a what?
On the
real estate investment trust. Don't get off on that.
Okay, but you're saying that there's a fundamental conflict of interest in her merely working for that university?
No, she doesn't. She's a full-time tenured professor of law.
How does this affect the? I don't understand how this affects the public service debate we're having.
I don't care about the public. Well, okay.
Okay, well, enough said. Do you care to comment on that?
Well,
This has been brought up against you before.
No, I don't mind commenting. Every so often, there is an issue involving George Washington University, and I simply recuse myself from any vote or involvement in that. And the fact of the matter is, I think it's pretty synergistic, and I think my constituents who know from the beginning, and I've been there 10 years now, know that it's actually beneficial for me because of the insights I'm able to give with respect to my my constitutional law and criminal procedure background. So it hasn't been a problem, and
I fully report it,
and it's actually not an issue.
I want to move on. You chair the Committee on Transportation and the Environment. Metro, as we know, has struggled with reliability, safety issues, including more than just the safety of trains themselves. There's been an 8% increase in crimes on Metro, 69% increase at bus stops in the last year, which, in my view, don't get enough attention, and a number of incidents which have caught the media's attention, including a shooting on the Green Line in Anacostia earlier this week. This week we hear that Metro plans to step up security. What do you know about that?
Well, I just know what their announcement is. You know, Metro is its own governing body, although we have representatives from each of the jurisdictions, and our representative is Jack Evans, who's also the chair now of the Metro board. But with respect to those incidents, what I've been saying and others have been saying all along is that people not only have to be safe, they have to feel safe. And in terms of these incidents, what we have to do is we have to have a presence. You know, there's something called smart policing, hotspot policing, where you try to identify where these things tend to be breaking out and who's doing them and around what time of day. And while we want a presence generally, you can put a presence where these incidents have occurred and you know, provide security both psychologically to people, but also security in case something should happen. So it's a very important step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
But I think some critics might argue it's not that important. It is a response to the crime. Jack Evans said here on this program a couple of weeks ago something needed to be done. But what this plan is right now, Chief Pavlik, who is the chief of the Metro Police, said this is like a 5% increase in the number of officers who will be out on patrol within the Metro system and the bus routes. It's 17 officers who now are basically assigned to collect and secure the money that's collected around Metro and move it around. They will now be doing police work. But it still seems to be in this system, the police officers are just not visible. They're not at the front gates when you go in. They're not at the gates when you go out. They're not on the platform. And they're going to do this thing where a police officer will look onto when a train stops. An officer will go quickly and look inside the cars and see if everything's okay, and then the train will go along. But it's not a continual presence.
Well, to say that we need more is not to say that what the idea that they have and what they are doing is not good. I think
right.
it is
Oh,
good.
Yeah, right. It is good. And it's the right direction.
Right. It's the right direction, and we probably need to do more. But the other thing is, even if you have limited resources, it's how you deploy those resources. And that's the thing I want to emphasize. If they're finding out, for example, what they're calling these wild packs or something like that, if they're happening at the end of school, near certain high schools, on certain lines, at certain times, they ought to have the force multiplier there.
Right, just as there are D.C. police officers outside those Metro stops. And
precisely
places.
Right. So I do think it matters, though I agree with you entirely. You know, the more we could do, it would be better.
Nevertheless, and in spite of, the New York-based company Smart Asset says Metro is the number one for public transit, comparing 136 Metro areas across the nation. They looked at average commute time for transit users, percentage difference between average commute times of car commuters and transit users, percentage of commuters who use public transit, total number of commuters who use public transit, and the difference between the citywide median income and the median income for transit users. Does that provide any context
that's,
at all?
That's fine, and I'm glad that we have something to tout, but you have to look at the indicia for what makes you number one.
Indicia? Right, you are a professor.
We have to look at the basis on which you get to be number one. So if we have more transit users per capita, Does that say that you're safer on the subway?
No, it doesn't address safety at all.
Right. It doesn't address safety at all. And it doesn't address other issues that people have about Metro. And, in fact, I saw on one of the TV stations when that first came out, a reporter went out just to interview people randomly and say, so, you know, we're number one in the nation. What do you think of that? And there was, like, looks of shock and surprise.
Well, I suspect that if you interview transit riders in other cities, you'll hear a lot of complaints.
The fact is there is a core good metro system that was built here and is expanding with the Silver Line out into Virginia and elsewhere. It is a core good system. We have a core good bus system. The problem is we have too many problems with the core system. It doesn't matter where some organization ranks Metro. If you are told endlessly, quote, allow extra time, unquote, because you can't get there where you want to go, then it doesn't matter what you rank. And that's the problem with Metro. It has a public relations image, it has an infrastructure image problem, and it has a fare problem.
We haven't kept up with the
subway built, you know, in the 70s.
Have to move on to our next guest pretty soon, but the mayor and a rather large regional delegation, including a few of your council colleagues, traveled to Cuba. They just returned to study the education system, to push for more trade ties. What do you think is the benefit for the region in Cuba? You've gone.
Well, I went under different auspices.
And Sherwood went.
In fact, I was invited to go on this one, and I declined because I didn't know if I had any value to add to the effort. So I did not go. But, you know, going regionally and seeing if there are some, you know, points of interconnection, I suppose something can come of it. I just don't know what the what.
Well, you can have businesses based in the District of Columbia who can work out businesses and deals in Cuba, and then we could maybe benefit from that as long as our tax structure allows it.
Right.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have with you today. Mary Che, thank you so much for
joining us.
Gracias. Mary Che is a D.C. council member. She's a Democrat who speaks Spanish and legalese. She represents Ward 3 in the District of Columbia. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, over in Virginia, they have decided to shelve that proposal that would have protected or kept secret, if you will, the identity of police officers all across the state. It was a conversation that we had here yesterday with the executive of the Chiefs of Police Association in the Commonwealth of Virginia and two reporters. It was a very spirited discussion, but it would appear that the general impression that was gotten from this piece of legislation is that police would be able to have their identities forever kept secret, regardless of the circumstances. And I think it would appear that one of the reasons they shelved the bill is because that's not a good look.
It's, you know, there's a popular phrase these days when you talk about public policy and you talk about the optics of it.
Yes.
How it looks. And the Senate had passed this bill in Virginia 25-15, and then the House panel committee rejected it yesterday. And the Virginia Press Association had cautioned and warned that this was not a good thing, that trying to cloak your officers in secrecy and anonymity is not a good thing when the public, you're fighting a battle to make sure the public supports you. As I always like to say, there are any zillions of numbers of police officers who every day do their jobs, wear their name tags proudly in the work they do, and this kind of sweeping idea that they have to become robots who they don't have names, they don't really have faces, and you wouldn't know how to get in touch with them.
Some people said it sounds like North Korea.
I think that's pretty extreme. But yes. I think the police want to engage more in the community. They don't want to be set apart from it, and I think that's the sentiment that prevailed in Richmond yesterday.
And over in the state of Maryland, Governor Hogan has a proposal that would have all of the proceedings on the floor of the General Assembly live video stream, because he says there needs to be more transparency.
Well,
it's one of a few states that doesn't do it.
Well, it's only like seven states that don't do it. But, you know, the Governor Hogan the Republican governor got everybody, the Democrats, upset with saying that they acted like they were on spring break. Well, if that is true, then I really do want to see the video of the floor. I mean, if they're having a party time in the legislature. But the serious part of the issue is citizens, we have so much digital media now and access immediately. I can call up on my cell phone right now and watch the D.C. Council if I want to. There's so many ways you can look at video. There's no reason for these legislators in the Senate and the House with their committee meetings and their floor votes. There's no reason people should not be able to see and hear that clearly. Right now you can listen to some of it, but you can't tell who's talking. Let's have cameras everywhere. I would like to see the camera in the U.S. Supreme Court, too.
Exactly. Joining us now in studio is David Anderson. He's a candidate in the Democratic primary for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. He's vice president of the Washington Center for Internships and Academic Seminars and an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University, where he teaches a course in government. David Anderson joins us in studio. Thank you very much for joining us.
Kojo, thank you very much.
If you have questions or comments for David Anderson, call now, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You run a nonprofit, so let me ask the Tom Sherwood question right from the very beginning. Exactly what is the Washington Center for Internships and Academic Seminars?
Yes. The Washington Center is the largest nonprofit college internship program in the country. I don't run the program. I'm Senior Vice President of State Relations. Pardon me?
Does that mean lobbyist?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not officially a lobbyist, but
okay.
I raise money from 13 state legislatures for college student scholarships so they can come to Washington for a semester-long or 10-week summer term. So in the last 11
for
years—
For academic credit.
For academic credit.
That's
so
important.
I've worked with Democrats and Republicans in 20 states successfully and raised millions of dollars for college students to come to Washington.
You also teach political scandal management.
Well, actually, I haven't taught that course for a while. I taught a politics and ethics class for 12 years at George Washington University, but I basically left academia in 2002. My scholarship that's really relevant to this campaign is focused on family policy, because I spent over 20 years writing about family policy, and I am running on the policy that I've developed. So the centerpiece of my campaign is a policy that says that when young families, hardworking middle class families, as soon as they have a child, we need to present an option to them. They should have either option A, which would be six months of paid parental leave plus $10,000 for child care support, or option B, the 6 months of paid parental leave and a tax credit for a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad. And it could be two moms or two dads. Now, what's distinctive about my view and what I've criticized Kathleen Matthews and Jamie Raskin for is that I reach out also to the stay-at-home moms and the stay-at-home dads. And the problem with Democratic policy for years has been we've been just trying to help the families that want to have the two-career model. But there are many families, moderate and conservative and even liberal families, who would prefer to have a parent, a mom or a dad at home, at least while the child is two or three or four. So all the efforts on Capitol Hill, including Senator Gillibrand and Representative DeLauro's effort to get paid parental leave, they've all failed. It's been 30 years and we don't have a dime. Federal dime of paid parental leave. And the reason these policies continue to fail is that Democrats, including my opponents, Senator Raskin and Ms. Matthews, they neglect the needs of half of families. So I have spent, in the last 2 months, I've been up to Frederick and Carroll counties 37 times knocking on doors, because those two counties, about half of those counties, are part of District 8.
6 months of family leave, would there be an income cap for, or would it be if you make a lot of money, if you make virtually no money, is there an income cap on your 6 months?
There would have to be an income cap, yes. Okay. And likewise with a tax credit for a stay-at-home parent. So I use the amount of, you know, $10,000 as that's probably what the cap would be. But the key is we have to reach out to the Republicans who control Congress now. If we ever hope to get more money for child care and certainly any paid leave, you have to say something to the Republicans that they're interested in. So of all the candidates in this race, and Bill Turk of the Washington Post has said all the candidates sound the same and Anderson is the lone dissenting voice. Of all the candidates
on this issue,
overall, on this issue and Social Security and
Terrible
Iran
Turk.
Nuclear.
Well, we always listen to what Terrible Turk has to say, but you describe yourself as a center-left progressive.
That's right.
Is that the center part you were just describing there for us?
That is exactly right. So a left-wing progressive like Senator Raskin, supports paid leave and more child care. Anderson here, I support that option as well as paid parental leave and a tax credit for a stay-at-home parent. So I am trying to make a policy that would be open to all families and not just those families that want the two-career
model. In order
model.
That people understand what a center-left progressive right. is, would you describe Hillary Rodham Clinton as a center-left progressive?
Basically, I would, yes. So I'm going to vote for Secretary Clinton. Yep. And yes.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the center-progressive.
Center-left progressive.
But anyway, let's move on. Yeah. One of the things you've done I thought was interesting, that this is a pretty big 8th district. It's fairly large in Maryland for all who are listening. You know, it includes Montgomery County, but goes up to Frederick County and Carroll County. And you've been up there a lot. You've been quoted in the Frederick paper as saying that you think those two counties get far less attention from the politicians from Montgomery County. Where do you live?
I live in Potomac near Herbert Hoover Middle School.
Okay. Now, do you live in the when initially there was some confusion about you actually in fact live in the 8th district?
No, there is no confusion.
There was initially.
I do not live in the 8th district. We're right on the border. Okay. My daughter's school, half of it is in 8 and half in 6. I voted for Chris, who's an old friend of mine, and I certainly support him in the Senate race 5 times, but with the gerrymandering, they pushed us out by a few blocks.
There are people listening who will wonder if you can run for a district
legally,
if you do not
live. If you live in the state, and I pledge that we would move back 7 or 8 blocks in
so
the
you,
district.
Okay. But I want to talk about Frederick and Carroll, because I'm sure we have some listeners there. Mm-hmm. You take all the voters in those two counties, though, they don't match the number of voters in Montgomery County. It sounds almost like you're trying to position your, given the other opponents in the race who are all kind of from Montgomery County, that you're trying to reach out to those two counties especially.
Well, that's exactly right. As I've said to the voters, and I've been to 12 different towns, as I said, 37 times since December, I explained to the voters that my values have more in common with the families, the Democratic families, and the seniors in Frederick and Carroll counties than they do with the Montgomery County progressive establishment. Now, this race, there's 9 of us in it now. The person who wins will have the most votes. You don't need a majority. So someone may end up with 16 or 17 or 20% of the vote. And Carroll and Frederick in this race, some experts say, will produce 15 to 20% of the votes. So I'm certainly trying to get votes in my home county. You know, I'm proud to be a citizen of Montgomery County, and there are
you make
many
it sound
people.
Like Montgomery's kind of elitist and not as concerned about the working poor and working isolated families in more rural sections of the district. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that is broadly correct. The entire county is not as liberal as Tacoma Park or Chevy Chase, for example. But I regard myself as the least liberal member of the pack, but the most inclusive, because by reaching out to the stay-at-home moms and the stay-at-home dads, or would-be stay-at-home moms and stay-at-home dads, as well as to the two-career model, and by reaching out to the citizens, and that includes the Republicans ultimately, because whoever gets elected has to represent the whole county. By reaching out to Frederick and Carroll, I am the most inclusive of all the candidates, and I'm not neglecting anyone.
David Anderson is joining us in studio. He's a candidate in the Democratic primary for Maryland's 8th Congressional District seat. He's vice president of the Washington Center for Internships and Academic Affairs. If you have questions or comments for David Anderson, call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org.
Well, let's talk briefly about Social Security.
Yes.
You are among the, I don't know all the candidates' positions, but as I understand it, you would like to raise the age of Social Security from 66 to what?
Well, first, there's 2 parts to my view. The first part is really a liberal part, and the second part is the more conservative part. First, I think we should increase the monthly payments of those 36% of seniors who rely on Social Security for 90 to 100% of their retirement.
I was going to get to the payouts of Social Security.
Right. But that's the first part. But the second part, you're right. I believe, and I agree with some Republicans here, that we should roll back the age eligibility by 2 years. Early retirement would move from 64. it's currently 62. And full retirement would really move from 67 to 69. Now, I do think that
Why?
Because people are living longer and we have better health care. And if we don't roll it back, we're either going to have to raise the
person,
tax.
A worker who were, yeah. who, just for example, where yeah. would this start, though? Because if
we give a 10-year in advance heads-up notice. You only tell people when they're about 50. This is nothing that would affect
right
anyone
now. Right
now,
people know it. Is it 66 and 67?
It's just about 67. Okay. They keep
right, we'll just
moving
say 67.
It up. Right.
If you're going to move it to 69, you would then say to people you'd have to be under 59 or something like that in order for that change to affect you.
Yes, you know. This would be years from now. You know, early retirement is currently 62.
Yeah,
but you see, if we don't push back the age eligibility, we really have to do one of two things. We have to lift the cap from like $118,500 maybe to $300,000, or we have to increase the tax. Now, one of the problems with my opponent's views is that they present views that would never get agreed to on Capitol Hill. So the very idea that we could raise the cap to like $250,000, the Republicans would never agree to that. So my opponents who say that, you know, that's just not realistic. See, I am a realistic progressive. So my views on Social Security, you see, have two parts. The first part is basically the liberal part. So when I went up in Walkersville and knocked on the door, and an African-American woman, 65, answered the door, and I explained my view to her. I'll just call her Miss Jones. And I told her that those seniors who are choosing between food and medicine, who are in that 36%, I want them to have $70 more a month. And that's up on my website. And then I told her the second part, and the end of the conversation, she said, "You have my vote." So in the short run, my approach is if you like, very liberal. But the long-term sustainability issue, I'm trying to
be more
fiscally
responsible.
Allow me
to go to the telephones. Here is Hamza in Germantown, Maryland. Hamza, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. My name is Hamza Khan. I'm the president of the Muslim Democratic Club of Montgomery County. It is believed that there are around 100,000 Muslims in Montgomery County. Forgive me if I can't give you off the top of that what my source is. We're putting together a report that will come out at the end of the year based on census data and voter file data. Mr. Anderson, we spoke at the Montgomery County Young Democrats Congressional Forum some weeks ago, and at that time you made it very clear that you are the only Democrat who is currently running in the 8th District who publicly opposes the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal. In addition to that, in a follow-up question, you were asked about the current congressional law that was passed that affects Iranians who are Iranian by birth and are denied entry into the U.S. on a visa waiver law. And you said you also supported that. You also refused to attend last night's environmental racism event, which had over 50 people.
What's your question here? Hamza?
Yeah, sorry, Kojo. The question basically is, what did you say to the Muslim constituents of congressional age who you seem to be purposefully ignoring and doing your best to antagonize?
Well, I wasn't invited to the event last night. I'm not sure what that was, and I'm sorry I missed it. I have no intention to be what word did you use to be antagonistic towards the Muslim community. In my house with my daughter and with my stepson, we talk about respect for all religions, and we talk a lot
about talk issues. Why do you oppose the Iranian deal?
Right. Well, I was on the board of directors of the American Jewish Committee's Washington board for 10 years, so my views more or less line up with AJC. So last summer when this was being debated, I thought actually that the arguments on both sides were good. It was the most complicated.
You sound like a referee more than a candidate.
Well, I want to start off by telling it was a very complicated issue.
Well, everything's complicated.
And I was opposed to the way both sides were cartooning the other side. However, I came down on the same side as Senator Cardin. And yes, I am opposed to the Iran, or was opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. I did not think it was in the best interests of the United States or Israel. I was especially concerned with the $100 billion that would be used by Iran for terrorism. So I thought that the work of the administration.
What do you mean the $100 million
that would be used by Iran for terrorism? Well, that was
the
speculation. That the money that was freed up, there was much speculation that Iran would use that to cause, you know, mayhem in the Middle East, including in Israel. And this is a country in whose supreme leader and other leaders were continued to chant death to Israel, death to the United States.
This race seems like something of a microcosm of the Democratic Party. One candidate, Delegate Ana Sol Gutierrez, says she's the first Latina, would be the first Latina elected in the state, or she talks about being the first Latina elected in the state. Another, Will Jawando, African-American candidate, notes that 90% of our elected officials in the country are white. He says that's not an accident. Kathleen Matthews asks, well, if we're looking for radical, there's nothing more radical than electing the very first Democratic woman in the 8th Congressional District. What do you feel about this argument that the state is diverse but that its elected leaders don't represent that? You would be another white male being elected in the state.
Well, there are a lot of interesting candidates in the race. As I've said, I believe I'm the most inclusive of all candidates. I studied feminist theory in the 1980s and wrote a doctoral dissertation about issues.
You got a PhD in philosophy?
Yes, I do. A PhD in philosophy from the University of Michigan. I have spent several decades trying to understand and reach out to the LGBT community in my writings, to women, to persons of different race. I mean, I'm Jewish, so I grew up basically in a house learning about racial oppression and religious oppression, and I have great sympathy and empathy for whether it's Muslims or Hispanics. So,
okay. You're inclusive.
I am totally inclusive,
right,
and not saying I should be
elected.
We have
about a minute left.
Let's talk politics. This is a politics hour.
Yeah.
How much money do you have in your campaign bank account right now?
Well, that's a good question. My total...
What's the answer?
Yeah. We raised about $130,000.
How much do you have
point.
Do you have in the bank?
Right now, it's probably under $50,000 with more money coming in.
Other than being on this program and other free media places, how do you compete in a campaign that costs millions of dollars and where Kathleen Matthews is all over the radio and other television, and Jamie Raskin has a lot of in the district support and money?
Money's not a bad thing, is it? No, it's a very good question, and I wish I had $1 million.
Dollars.
Part of it is face-to-face. As I told you, I have knocked on doors in 37
You can't knock on enough doors.
You can't knock on enough, but there is word of mouth. We have a new social media coordinator. We are doing direct mail, but I am heavily targeted on the two northern counties. So I am also getting good media from the Washington Post and here.
David Anderson, he's a candidate in the Democratic primary for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. David Anderson, thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Appreciate it.
Tom Sherwood, will you be riding the streetcar tomorrow?
I will be going. I don't know. I'm going to see if it works.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, what